the Oxford Middle East podcast. My name is Piotr Schokas, and today I'm joined by the whole Almanac team to discuss notable events that took place in 2021, developments we're keeping an eye on in 2022, and our favourite Middle East related books.
After 3.5 years of a crisis that threatened the very core of the Gulf region, GCC leaders have agreed to end divisions and usher in a new era of cooperation.
Foreign countries are scrambling to evacuate their nationals, including diplomatic staff, from Afghanistan. The US is also having to consider helping Afghans who worked with their forces, making themselves potential targets for the Taliban.
Lebanon is ending the year in a state of paralysis while starting this new year in one. Its cabinet hasn't met for 2 months. The currency continues to lose value, and the investigation into 2020's port blast in Beirut stalled.
We begin in the Middle East, where both Israeli forces and Palestinian militants have stepped up their attacks in the worst fighting seen in years. The UN now warning of the risk of full-scale war.
So hello everyone, welcome to our New Year's episode. What's going to happen today is that each of the people present is going to say what their big event of the past year, so that would be 2021, was. They will say what they're looking out for in 2022, and then they will also say what their favorite book about the Middle East is. So we'll do one person at a time, and we will start with you, Kalyani, so please go ahead.
Okay, so I, kind of imagining what other people would be talking about, decided to kind of go local to my interests in terms of what I thought was a very significant event of 2021. And that was the Boğaziçi University student protests in Turkey that took place basically over more than the first half of the year, from January up until late August. Basically, to contextualize it, demonstrations broke out on 4th of January against the appointment of Melihbulu by President Erdogan. Melihbulu was appointed as the rector of Boğaziçi University, which is basically like the dean or et cetera, or president or whatever. Yet another impingement on sort of academic freedoms and freedom of thought in Turkey. As a result, hundreds of students gathered, and you know, academics protested as well. And it wasn't contained only to Istanbul, but of course there were protests in Ankara and several other places across Turkey. And one of the reason I chose it actually is, first of all, because you have to take it in the context of what sort of Erdogan's legacy in Turkey and what's been happening since really 2016, where the coup attempt really sort of resulted in Erdogan trying to exert his stranglehold of power, intellectual and sort of physical power over Turkey as a whole, and especially Istanbul, which was still like sort of a bastion of quote-unquote left-leaning thought. So that was one part of it. And the other is Boğaziçi University itself, which is kind of not just a left-leaning university, but also a university that attracts students from across Turkey of all sort of social classes, etc. So you would have very sort of conservative Muslim students protesting alongside, you know, pro sort of either whatever communist, pro LGBTQ, whatever it is, students. And they were all coming together. It's very rare to have that happen in Turkey, but they were all coming together to protest this, the appointment of this rector. I would have loved to have said, like, if we'd done this a little earlier, like, let's say halfway through the year, I'd have been like, you know what, maybe this is the sign of Erdogan sort of losing his grip over the youth of Turkey, etc., which many people had wished it was. I think it's still significant because it shows that the protest is still alive despite his 18 years in power. Nonetheless, he has appointed a rector of his own choosing to replace the same one. So he kind of capitulated, but then did the same thing again. So we'll see what happens with that. And that's sort of what I'm looking to see in 2022, whether these protests that are happening at Boğaziçi sort of continue in a certain way. And I think it was a bit naive to hope that maybe these protests signal change across Turkey and maybe a shift in Erdogan's power on their own, at least. And we've seen that with his appointing the next rector all on his own, as well as like opening two more faculty departments as part of like a midnight order. But I do think that, and it should be mentioned, that the current tanking of the lira, which is ongoing and is currently dropped by like about 40% over the year against the dollar and 30% in November alone. It will be interesting to see whether Erdogan, who sort of first came into power with a very strong economic policy, whether this will sort of add to sort of the ongoing sort of intellectual, quote unquote, intellectual protest against him, whether this will actually be backed by sort of very serious economic considerations of the people, particularly after a pandemic. So I think that's, it would be interesting to see whether any of this actually shifts Erdogan's power, and in which case, how that will affect the larger region.
And your book?
The book I chose is Shah of Shahs by a Polish journalist whose name I'm going to butcher, but I'm going to try anyway, which is Ryszard Kapuściński. It was written in 1980, published in 1982. And it's a really short book. It's by no means sort of like, if you want an, you know, a complete history of the Iranian revolution, this is not it. But nonetheless, it's a really good account of basically the decline of Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi and sort of the rise of Khomeini from a journalist's perspective. So he was in Iran at the time. He was holed up in a hotel. He's by no means an Iran expert in that sense. He doesn't know Farsi or anything like that. What he is an expert on is sort of report. He was a war correspondent, so and a foreign correspondent. So he's reported, you know, I think he reported about like 27 coups and revolutions over the course of his career. So while he's no expert on Iran, and I'm sure many people can sort of read into sort of, in some ways he stereotypes the Middle East, but in other ways he sort of is very sympathetic to the Iranian people, which is not something that happened at the time. At the time, it was very much, you know, why would they sort of go against democracy and choose Khomeini, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of the writing that came out of that time was sort of baffled at this quote unquote backward shift. But what he does instead is show the kind of suffering that was endured by the Iranian people under the Shah and under his the Savak, which is the secret police. And he's a very, very good writer as well. So for anyone sort of uninitiated to like Iranian history and who wants an easy read, it's less than 200 pages, but it's beautifully written. So this is what I chose for today's podcast.
Perfect. And Guy, you're next.
So my big event was the fall of Kabul and the withdrawal of the American forces from Afghanistan. I think that's pretty massive. It marks the end of the 20-year war since 9/11, and it ended with the defeat of the Americans and kind of their humiliation, which is pretty important. I think it's really humiliated the Americans in the region and in the world as a whole, and marks a sort of slow drawback and withdrawal of American power in the region and the wider world. There's also going to be a massive economic crisis. There is an economic crisis in Afghanistan. You've got a lot of commentators saying that there's going to be potentially humanitarian catastrophe, since a lot of people in Afghanistan were reliant on a sort of rentier system with foreign aid and donor funds going to feeding people, basically. Now those funds have been frozen, and the US has even frozen $9.5 million, I think, in the central bank. The Taliban are really going to struggle to look after the people in general. On top of that, it's a war-torn country, so it's going to be a bit of a mess. Besides that, you've also got the Qataris and who support one faction, and the Pakistanis who support another. And you've got other regional players like China, Iran, who are also going to try and have influence in some way or another. What I'm looking out for in 2022 is kind of similar to that, related to that. So I'm interested in how China's going to step into the shoes, I suppose you could say, that the US has left. They won't be the same kind of vibe at all. China's got its own special way of doing things, with a lot more money lending and a lot less going for human rights in apostrophes or whatever. It'll be interesting to see how they express their interest and pursue their interest in places like China, Central Asia, which are both incredibly important for their Belt and Road Initiative, and as well how they relate to the Gulf countries. That'll be fun. Yeah, especially in the context, we can't forget, of rising antagonism or rhetoric of rising antagonism between East and West. I think everyone will notice that, like, in the last couple of years, China, from being a sort of neutral place that people don't really think about in an adversarial sense, now a lot of people in Western countries are talking about China as the next enemy and a Cold War 2.0. So it'll be interesting in this Cold War to see which side the Middle Eastern countries or countries of that region will choose, if they have to choose a side, if the Americans will push them, if the Chinese will push them. I'm excited to see. My book that I've chosen is Ottoman Odyssey by Alev Scott. So completely unrelated. Alev Scott's a British-Turkish journalist. So she goes to initially Turkey before she gets banned in search of traces of the Ottoman Empire, usually in the form of minorities. So she talked to the Afro-Turks, who are descendants of slaves in Turkey, and have their own sort of culture and their own understanding of self. She talks to Bosniaks who don't speak Turkish but have a strong connection to, or like have an adoration for Erdogan and the Ottoman Empire. And a lot of it is about how nationalism swept away all of this heterogeneity, but traces of it still remain, which is pretty exciting and cool.
Then it is my turn. My big event of the year, like both relate to Israel. The first was the Israeli elections, because after over a decade in power, Netanyahu finally left under a cloud of controversy. And I was very happy to see that, because I thought he was an odious man. The unfortunate situation is that my massive hopes of it being an improvement, or the new government being an improvement over the old one, were dashed when in May the Israelis started bombing Gaza, which is the second half of my big event of the year. It's not only, you know, my big event of the year because it was sad and horrific what happened, but what I did realize, and some of you might have realized it as well, was how active it seemed people in the West were about it. Like, it seemed to be much more prevalent on social media than previous Israeli incursions in the West Bank or into Gaza. And friends of mine who had never really cared about the conflict before got in touch with me, and in order to ask me if I could send them good articles or give them some information about why it was happening or who they could donate to. And the fact that, and their twins, Mohammed Al-Qurd and Mona Al-Qurd, I think they both also were named by Time magazine as among the 100 most influential people in the world, which shows how big the Palestine question has become the last 2 years. So for me, those were very encouraging developments, despite the very sad situation in which they happen. So on the other hand, like Gaza and Sheikh Jarrah and Israel as a whole is very sad, but the fact that it is getting so much more attention is very positive. And also it shows that I'll just call it propaganda of Israel at times hasn't been quite as effective in among younger people as it has among older people. The thing I'm looking out for next year, there's two of them. One of is the same as last year, which is the death of the Saudi king. I'm not looking forward to it necessarily, but I'm very curious what's going to happen if he dies, just as I was 1 year ago. Because if he dies, he is part of the old guard of Middle Eastern leaders. And will that change, for example, Saudi Arabia's stance towards Israel? Also, will that cause the changes currently happening in Saudi Arabia to go even faster? Because Mohammed bin Salman now feels that as king, he has even more absolute power than he already does. So that's, for me, going to be interesting. The second thing is the normalization with Syria. In October, the Jordanian king had a phone call with Assad. Assad has also been visited the UAE, and Syria will host the energy conference in 2024. So it does seem that these countries, unfortunately, are repairing their relationships with Assad, which, you know, again, he is also an even more odious man than Netanyahu was. So I'm a bit disappointed, I guess, that he is being allowed back into the fold. But on the other hand, I also totally understand that you can't keep him out forever, even though I feel that would be the more reasonable approach. Regarding books, my books are the same as last year, so I'm not going to mention them. But what I'm instead going to do is mention what the people who were on this episode last year predicted, just to see how everything's gone. The first thing is Felix. He mentioned the Libyan civil war, which I guess has had a relatively positive development. There's been a rapprochement between Turkey and the UAE, so they're not on opposite sides of the war there anymore, or not as much. The Libya has also announced elections in which the son of Gaddafi is going to run, if I'm not mistaken. So hopefully he doesn't win, because that would be a bit of a sad state of affairs. Michael mentioned that he was looking out for Biden's approach to Iran and the JCPOA. The re-entry of America or Iran into the JCPOA has so far not happened, and especially because of the current Iranian government, you know, there has been very little progress. On the other hand, many Israeli intelligence and military officials have said that Netanyahu's Iran policy, which was very much in line with Trump's Iran policy, was a narrow-minded and counterproductive policy. So at least there seems to be a bit of reflection on that side. Freddie mentioned the normalization of Arab states with Israel. There hasn't been any progress there. After we recorded, Morocco and Bahrain both normalized relations, but that has been fairly inconsequential. I mentioned the Saudi king. He is still alive. Hawaja looked at more Arab involvement on Morocco's side in the Western Sahara, but I haven't been able to find any clear information on developments. Like the UN peacekeeping mission was renewed and Algeria has closed its airspace to Morocco, but that's it. But we have done an episode on it, so I'd recommend people who haven't done so to listen to it. Rose looked at how Iran was doing, and the answer to that is incredibly poorly. The inflation is above 40%. There's been water protests. There's a massive number of COVID deaths, and they have had their election in massive quotation marks earlier this year. Max also looked at elections, and he was hopeful, but in the end, they ended up going the wrong way, and the hardliners won. And Helena hoped that Lebanon's situation would improve, and that has absolutely not happened. There's blackouts, there's a lack of medicine, there's sectarian violence. So overall, the outlook from last year has not been very good for this year. And with that, my part is done. So go ahead, Isabella.
All right. Well, actually, as I was listening to Guy, got me thinking a little bit more about my big event for 2021. And I actually began to think even more about, say, gender relations, which is actually a big interest of mine. So what I had previously planned to talk about is actually going to shift a little bit. So I'll be answering differently. But like Guy, my big event from 2021, being from the US and living in the US this past year before coming to Oxford, was, of course, the fall of Kabul and the US withdrawal from Afghanistan. Being in the US when this happened, obviously, this was huge news and was highly controversial in the US, just as it was everywhere around the world news-wise. So I know there were lots of people in the US that were for the withdrawal to say, quote, end the war, bring the soldiers back home, all of those, all of that kind of rhetoric. And then there were plenty of other people in the US that were highly concerned about how hasty this withdrawal would be and what situation it would leave Afghanistan in. And as we have seen, the fallout has been pretty serious with the fall of Kabul and the Taliban's effective takeover. I think what I'm sort of looking out for in 2022 as a result is to see what will occur with women's rights in Afghanistan and gender relations. I know that the Taliban has answered several questions. I think even NPR, one of NPR's journalists had interviewed a member of the Taliban and received answers sort of based on women's rights, such as, oh, women will have rights, they will be, quote, respected, all of these things. But there has also been other sources saying that that's not really what's occurring as of right now. There's been talk of even forced marriages occurring in Afghanistan between Taliban soldiers and women. So it will be interesting to see how women's rights are negotiated by Taliban leadership. That's what I'm sort of looking out for in 2022, is what gender relations and the situation for women will look like in Afghanistan.
And your book?
The book would be, thank you for reminding me, would probably be, I took a course when I was in undergrad called Peoples and Cultures of the Middle East, and we read several ethnographies in the course. The course actually sealed my interest in Middle Eastern studies. One book I remember, I think it was the first one we read actually, that really made an impact on me and sort of made me very interested, especially in gender relations in the Middle East, was by an anthropologist, Palestinian-American anthropologist named Lila Abu Lugov. And this ethnography that she wrote was called Veiled Sentiments. And it was written during the time she was with a Bedouin community in the Western desert of Egypt. So she studied gender relations and oral lyric poetry of young men and women. So I really enjoyed the book, and it just made me more interested in Middle Eastern studies as a discipline, and specifically in gender relations.
Oliver, are you ready?
So my big event from 2021, which is a very big event, sadly links to one of the sort of looking forwards from last year, which is the descent of Lebanon into further crisis. Obviously, after the Beirut explosion of August 2020, there was hope with money coming in from abroad, and that, you know, Lebanon might, with the coming of 2021, might be looking up, as was hoped by someone on the podcast last year. But as you mentioned, Piotr, already, sadly, that hasn't been the case. The already crushing inflation, which has been going on since 2019, has gotten worse and worse, with, I believe, the Lebanese pound on the black market in January beating at about 9,000 Lebanese pound to the dollar, where it today stands at 28,500 to the dollar. So obviously that's led to a lot of the country plunging. I think about more than 80% of the country is now living in poverty. Obviously, the financial crisis has led to fuel shortages, which have been very widely publicized, with, I believe, in October, the two main power stations in the country shutting down, leaving the country completely without electricity, which obviously during the pandemic is even more disastrous because, you know, this has led to hospitals not having electricity, having to count on generators which are run by diesel, which then hasn't been available either. So for me, that's been a really big thing. I visited Lebanon myself in January of this year, and I was able to see there, you know, the effects of inflation, and also got caught up in a huge COVID lockdown, which seemed very unfair on the people because all shops were closed and left people with no way of getting essential things which they needed. There has been a tiny positive point, which is that in September, Lebanon finally got a new government, which resigned. The previous government resigned after the explosion, of course, in 2020. I am not too optimistic about it because the government is led by Najib Mikati, who's been prime minister a few times before. He's a well-known Lebanese billionaire. Well, I think a lot of the world looks at Lebanon and feels a completely new approach is needed. Mikati hails from exactly the same political class of people who led Lebanon into the crisis, which it is now. So that was a really big thing for me, which I'm sadly not too optimistic about. And then the thing I'm looking out for in 2022 is Lebanon's neighbor, which is the further development of the conflict in Syria. Obviously, the Syrian conflict was really really publicized in 2015, 2011, with ISIS rising to power. But now, for quite a long time, people seem to have sort of forgotten about it. Well, actually, I think we're further away from a solution there than we or than Syria ever has been. In the north of the country, there's this military stalemate, which is hugely complex, obviously being the battleground for a proxy war. And then the political stalemate, where, for example, in October, the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva failed to draft a constitution. And then, of course, there were the elections in 2021 as well, the first since 2014, where Assad won 95% of the vote and now has been sworn in as president until 2028. So I'm really looking out to see any developments. But again, I'm not very hopeful because it seems that not much is going to be changing. And all the while, the people of Syria have had horrendous poverty and hunger have reached an all-time high. Prices of essential products have gone up by hundreds of percents. But I always look forward, you know, to 2022 or perhaps beyond with some hope, even though that is sort of tucked away behind lesser expectation. And then my favourite book, at the moment, obviously, it's very hard to pick. Links in with this. It is the book called Destroying a Nation, The Civil War in Syria, which has only come out in 2017. Being Dutch, I have to bring a little Dutch element into this. It was written by Nicolaas van Dam, who is a Dutch scholar, but also very, very experienced Dutch diplomat, who was ambassador to a string of countries, including Iraq, Egypt, and Turkey, and many others. And in 2015, he was appointed the Dutch special envoy to Syria. So he has an unparalleled combination of you know, experience and knowledge of Syria. And the book is obviously a comprehensive account of the Syrian conflict, but it's also very clear. And the great thing of it is that Nicolaas van Dam dedicates a huge portion of it, as is necessary, I think, to understanding the conflict, to the rise of the Ba'ath Party, and basically a huge summary of Ba'athist history, which enables, you know, because so many things are linked, the conflict doesn't stand alone. In 2011, so many things have been running in Syria since the 70s and 80s, which have just been waiting to burst, as they did. And the thing I enjoyed about the book as well is that obviously Nicolaas van Dam, being a diplomat, he also dedicates quite a bit at the end to looking forward to potential ways that can be gone about to find a solution, or just potential scenarios, which again don't sadly look very promising for at least the next year, but hopefully in the future. So I could definitely recommend it to anyone who has an interest in Syria, because it is a fantastically written book as well by someone who has really, really great knowledge of the region.
Go ahead, Adam.
So for me, 2021 has been, obviously it's been extremely eventful in terms of political events in the Middle East, or what we call the Middle East, I would say Southwest Asia. I would say that my most important thing was in Palestine, what happened in May. The events in May in Palestine have been something, I wouldn't say maybe it's a stretch to say that they were unprecedented, but they were definitely something that we haven't seen in a while. And the reason wasn't because of the violence. It wasn't because of the scale of the events. It was because Palestinians from all over the world, but most importantly, inside of historic Palestine, have been able to find unity in their struggle against Zionism. And that I've been speaking to people in Haifa, I've been speaking to people in Nazareth, I've been speaking to people in the West Bank and in Gaza,